something. This is for the first place where they know me like this, and that's for the second place. I guess we'll combine the files. That's the Mishnah, now we're going to the Gemara. So that's the Mishnah file. Now we have the Gemara file. Okay. I'm in the Gemara on page 34, Bet, of the fourth chapter of Gittin. And I'm going to start now in terms of the Gemara, and we're going to hold, as I was saying, we're going to hold out and think about the names issue in general. Because tonight I want to think about names as one of those hypertext kind of issues that have come about here in learning this Gemara. You all know by now that sometimes, whether it's exactly connected to this page in Gemara, the whole question of names obviously is one on the page, regardless of the specifics of the divorce case that's being dealt with. We have to figure out what the rabbi's thinking about names really is all about. Is there Torah, Talmud, Mishnah, Talmud on the inyan, on the matter of names? And there will be some Torah on that. There will be some Talmudic passages about names and what they mean and whether or not we learn anything about people by their names and how that all plays out in this section of the Gemara, particularly this page, 34. I'm going to also say that later on we're going to get a little bit of notion about names that comes out on page 36. And what I think is going on philosophically, or I am drushing it and I'm reading it that way, and I'm going to make some meaning out of the fact that there's some conversation about names, is that we can learn philosophically a little bit about what the rabbi's worldview was vis-a-vis individuals who are called by their names, and maybe more than one name. And that's at play here in the pages of the Talmud. And it's not only about the divorce cases and how we're going to effectively, legally, make valid divorces happen or not. But I'm going to hold off on those sources until we look inside the Gemara right here and relate to this Mishnah that basically said, if I don't have every name a person's called by on the document, how am I going to really know that this divorce is actually legal?
Why they don't use the names on the ketubah? They already got married. They have a divorce paper basically prearranged. They have the names there. They have the cities. They have everything. Why they need to go through all these...
You could really ask why they don't use the ketubah names when they have a ketubah. And that doesn't appear here. Let's just hold that.
So they didn't have ketubah at the time?
Let's hold that open. Why we don't go to another legal document, especially for a married couple. Okay. Let's pull into this Gemara. The Gemara relates the incident that prompted Rabban Gamliel to issue this decree. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Shalchu le b'nei medinat hayam l'Rabban Gamliel. The people of the diaspora sent the following inquiry to Rabban Gamliel in Eretz Yisrael. By the way, from this we know that there were oftentimes diaspora communities that would send questions through messengers and through letters and through students to rabbis who were considered to be in the, you know, Jewish headquarters of the world. This practice would go on and be further articulated not only during Talmudic times, but during Gaonic times, post-Talmud, when we had Sasanian, Persian, and what are still called the Babylonian institutions, and it would change over to the great institutions of our geniuses in Jewish law and who had the knowledge of all the Talmud. People would send letters. Of course, there's also letters of Rambam, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, And he writes epistles to the Jews of Yemen and other letters to other people. This is a way that we wanted to relate to authority figures within Jewish circles. So, all right. B'nei Adam haba'im misham lechan, people who come from there, Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, to here. Meaning, where? In Babylonia. For example, he's going to give, Shmo Yosef, the Korin lo Yochanan. So one's original name was Yosef, but here they call him Yochanan. By the way, I always thought it was, you could read it a little differently, because, you know, when you go to Israel, people have a much easier time with a chet. You know, when we were naming our children, our rules were, we're not going to use a chet, a chaf, and we're not going to, like, you know, for those who really say ayin with a guttural, we're going to, you know, going to avoid it. We weren't going to use a resh, for however, you know, you want to. So we were really limiting ourselves in terms of Hebrew names here. Meanwhile, so Yochanan sounded to me like an Eretz Yisraeli name, where Yosef sounded to me like a Babylonian name, except that makes sense. Yosef is a biblical name, and Yochanan is, you know, the land of Rabbi Yochanan is a very famous sage, and the Talmudic culture comes up, and Rabbi Yochanan's name is used here. Anyway, Yochanan, the Korin lo Yosef, here's the basic opposite. It can work either way. You could be Yochanan in one place and Yosef in the other. In other words, hey, ach megarshin nishotein. How can they divorce their wives if there are people who will not recognize these very husbands simply by the names that are written in the get? Because if you told me at first that the only names they used were the names that they used in the place where the get was written, when the get's delivered over to the woman in the other place and everybody knows the guy by the opposite name, no one's going to think there was ever a divorce. Amad Rabban Gamliel, v'hitkin, Rabban Gamliel rose up. Now, I don't think we've had the word Amad yet, but he gets up. So it's a nice term. And it actually, for me, in the Gemara, when I think about these kind of fixes on the law and how to rebuild society, you know, what's the immediate connection for me when I hear the word he stood up, Amad? What is our central prayer in our prayers? The Amida. And our getting up to pray in our culture is about gathering your force and your energy and your wisdom in order to help the basic fixing of the world. You know, that's really a drosh component of this. But if the verb has this kind of connotation in terms of a rabbinic action, I like to make that connection sometimes. Just, you can take a verb and the way it's used, make the connection miluli, as we say, word for word, and understand a little bit more about what you're doing during prayer. Anyway, Rabban Gamliel gets up. Amad Rabban Gamliel, v'hitkin, shehu chodvin ish ploni v'chol shum shiyesh lo. Rabban Gamliel rose and decreed that they should write in the get this and this man and every name that he has. Isha ploni v'chol shum shiyesh la. And this and this woman and every name that she has, mipnei tikkun olam, because it's going to fix the world. It says benefit of society in this translation. It says fix the world in some translations. The Gemara qualifies Rabban Gamliel's decree. What's the qualification? Amar Ravashi. Ravashi says the following. Dehu de'itcha zek bitre shme. Rabban Gamliel's decree applies only if it's established that he has two names. Okay? So, Amar Lei, Rabbi Abba, Ravashi, Rabbi Abba says to Ravashi, Rabbi Mari and Rabbi Elazar, Kaimu Kavatach. Rabbi Mari and Rabbi Elazar hold as you do, that Rabban Gamliel's decree applies only when it's established that he has two names. So, how do you establish such a thing? You try to understand it through the sources, and you try to understand it through... What do you think? Asking him, are you known by any other name? Some commentaries go and they say, it's a very simple and straightforward procedure. The person writing the get has some responsibility to actually ask the guy, are you known by any other name? that halacha has come down to us today, that Jewish law, and in the forms that are sent by someone who's called a Masader Gittin today, someone who writes gets, one of the entry spaces is your names, any names you are known by, you know, aliases, you know, just tries to make it for every possibility of how you are known in the world. And so, and it asks, by the way, are you known differently on your birth certificate than you are now? And, you know, being that the law just changed, it's even easier in New York City, in New York State, to change your name legally. It was kind of a burdensome process in the past, and now it's become less and less burdensome. There are forms to fill, and you can really just file. It's almost like to the point where it's one of these, you know, download your free legal form. And I do know a few people who have, by the way, changed their names in modernity because people call them something different. They just wanted to be that name. So,
legal to me, though, that it's the name that's on the ketubah.
Right. Ron asked that question as well, and it's Baruch Sheh Kivenu. There are people who ask the question, don't we have their names on legal documents? Well, no one wants to say that there were couples that didn't officially have any kind of ketubah. No one wants to say that. So they don't really ask and answer that question a lot.
Their names could be changed after the ketubah?
They could be, and they could be very well known otherwise. You know, the reality is that certain marriages did, in fact, they were consummated through other means than the delivery of the ketubah. We're seeing that in this age, a ketubah is going to be the absolute need, and that the ketubah itself, in order to be paid, has to be produced, and we know all that. But again, those who even want to say, just to relate back to the question, now I'll do it a little bit more, because we saw the Yosef and Yochanan inyan. I might have gotten married in place A, where I was known as Yosef, but then I really spent my life with my wife in place B, and I was known as Yochanan. So if I say it's only about the ketubah, and it was Yosef, right? And I was known as Yosef on the ketubah. Let me just finish my... Then I'm not really mentioning every name I had. So the name I have over here is Yochanan. So the ketubah doesn't satisfy everything, knowing what we know about Jewish people from this Gemara. This Gemara explains to us, it makes evident, that Jews had more than one name, potentially, in different places they lived. I could enter into a business contract as Yosef in place B, and someone could say, well, you don't have to honor it. It doesn't say that your name is Yosef in the ketubah, if we use the ketubah standard. So we're not going to use the ketubah standard. But we are going to make sure that the person's name is included in the list. And part of what the takana is, part of what the fix is from Rabban Gamliel, is in fact to include every name. Maybe the recalcitrant husband didn't want his name from the ketubah included. Now we're going to include every one of them.
Side question. Is there a relation between the verb hikin and the noun tikkun?
Yes, completely. That root, tav kuf nun, is the tikkun olam. It's the principle, fixing, tikkun, litaken. And then the Jewish legal process of fixing through legislation and deciding at a beitin is called hatkana, using the shorish tav kuf nun, the same as tikkun olam, fixing the world. So lahatkin is the legal process of making the new decree and legally deciding on, let's say, either a rectification or some new legislation.
That's the decree part. Is
correct.
It's the installation.
Ron, did you want to say something?
No.
Okay. This idea of a person having more than one name is not unusual because people are born in a place. My family, my parents' generation, everybody's born in Poland. during or after the First World War, they settled in Vienna. Not nice to have a name where people who already don't like Jews can pick you out for you. My father's name was Aaron, but he's known as Arnold. His brother, Izzy Disrael, is known as Irving. And even today, in business, we have Chinese friends and colleagues. They have two names.
Yeah. That's where I was going to go.
And Indonesians have their Indonesian name, the Chinese name, and another name when they're in the West.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's business,
fairly commonplace.
It's a business name.
Yeah.
In addition to their...
Pardon me?
It's like a business name. The Chinese have a business name that they use when they go outside the country, and then they have their own names.
Yeah, and in Indonesia, where most people we do business of Chinese origin, they are forced to take an Indonesian name, and they use their Chinese name, and they have another name.
Yeah, so it's very common.
Right.
So along those lines, many people came to America, and their names were given to them because of some writing a document or they said something and then they said, okay, that's your name. So in many people's cases when they were immigrants here, there's no relationship at all. It's just some other name. And some people I know of where they took someone else's name because that person was kind to them. So there's many issues.
Yeah, the passing along of names and stories about first names and last names, there are many different ways to make the connections right back to the Gemara. I think the Gemara is reflecting a very real human reality that you can be known by multiple names. And I think what they're doing, though, in terms of the rabbinic culture, is they're trying to flesh out what do we do to make sure on the legal front we are leaving no room or less room for someone to use an alias or neglect to include a name by which he or she is known in order to escape the consequences or you know, understand that there are legal ramifications. That they're looking sometimes at the beginning here, they were looking at the old practice and saying, there really is a possibility that someone's going to believe she's not divorced because instead of being called Yochanan, which he's called around here, he writes in Yosef. Now, it might just be, frankly, an innocent kind of thing because it might have been the way that they wrote a get. Just give me your name, and Yosef is sending you a get to such and such woman. But the problems might have really been brought to light by the fact that in that locality where the woman lived, there were major questions about her status. And they knew they needed to fix something. And the way that they're going to create legal documents and forms, if you will, or formats for writing legal documents, is based on some of the experience that we have with the reality that human beings have multiple names. And what are we going to do about it? And Rabban Gamliel is not willing to sit by and watch those problems unfold. He wants to take care of business and fix it. And that's where the takana comes in, the tikkun. So let's keep reading about what happens in these real life situations. Tanya Kavateda Rav Ashi, a braita was taught which accords with the statement of Rav Ashi. Remember, Rav Ashi did say that Rav Mari and Rav Elazar hold as you do that Rabban Gamliel's decree applies only when it's established that he's got the two names. Hayulo Shtei Nashim. Now, this gets into another issue we've mentioned before. Did anyone really have two wives or did they not? I told you that the Gemara is going to mention a case where someone actually has two wives. Here is one of those cases. Achat b'Yehuda v'achat b'Galil. He has one wife who lives in Judea and one in the Galilee. So you have to ask whether or not, by the way, there was some sense that that those areas were under two different authorities. There's some thinking in the ancient world that about the ancient rabbinic world that the Galilee region was really its own kind of, you know, protectorate or administrative area, and the Judea area also had its own sense, and you could really like float in between, and you didn't need a passport, but you really could sense that it was two very different areas, and people didn't pass between the two. So he's kind of like one of these guys keeping two households. Right? Veloshne Shemot. And he had two names. Echad Biudave, Echad Begalil. And he even has two names. One when he's up north and one when he's down south. Vegerashet Ishto Shebihuda Bishmo Shebihuda. And he divorced his Judean wife using his Judean name alone. Ve'et Ishto Shebegalil Bishmo Begalil. Or he divorced his Galilean wife using his Galilean name alone. Eina migoreshet. She is not divorced. Why? Ad sheyigareshet ishto shebihuda, bishmo shebihuda, v'shem degalilimo. Until he divorces his Judean wife using both the Judean name together with the Galilean name. And his Galilean wife using his Galilean name together with his Judean name. The Braita is basically here to prove the point. If you ask me really what's the point of this Maase Shehaya, this occurrence, I'm not even sure that it was a real case. But that it's a brighter that comes to basically say, no, Mishnaically, this is what Rabban Gamliel said was the law, and he means it. And remember last week we had the question about authority, and whether or not Rabban Gamliel's tikkun was going to stand. He said, sorry, you can't just organize that local beit din and nullify the get. And when somebody does, the question was, oh, but isn't the old way good enough? That this brayta comes to say, sorry, the old way is not good enough. The new law is the new law. Period. The brayta concludes, Yatza lemakom acher, he went to another place. He wasn't in Judea or the Galilee. V'gerash be'echad mehen, and he divorced either wife, using only one of his two names? Ah, but what happens? Migoreshet. She's divorced. So whereas the Braita, if it only existed about the Judea and the Galilee region and the two names, and there might have been confusion, I now see that they conclude in terms of an add-on that if he went to a different place where there might not be any confusion, where he's known by that second name, then she's divorced. Now that upends my strong read before of what the Braita was saying, right?
Right.
Except to say, and this is sometimes what we do in terms of reading the Gemara and Braitas, the question really is whether or not that was an affront to what the Braita said before, in the same way that the Gemara often asks the question. Are you saying that if he was in a third place, she wouldn't be divorced? What's the real question underlying that? Don't we want the fixing of the world, Tikkun Olam, to actually make this better for the wife? I think it gets to that level.
Yeah, but I think that's a protection for the husband, because if he said this is not my name, she will stay Aguna for life. When you have too many names and you have no proof, like in the Ketubah, of the original name, and she forced a divorce, he says, that's not my name, now I'm Yankel. And nobody can force to give him to, that he would give a get. So they protect the male rather than force the male. It's another reason for, you know, to be a bedazzled.
Meanwhile, I hear you. The Gemara is going to clear up the issue based on ultimately not Rabban Gamliel's law, but Rav Ashi's understanding of it, which is verified and supported by Rav Mari and Rav Elazar. What was Rav Ashi's take? That you only really needed to do what Rav Angamlio is saying when you verify that in fact he has two names. And they're going to say that it was two different cases. The first case in the Brita where he had to make sure to use both names was a case where indeed he had two names. The second case was a case where, what? Couldn't verify that he had two names. Zahamart. But you said in the first part of the Brita that using the Judean name, for example, is not effective unless what? Shem de Galil Imo, that you included the name that he had in the Galil. Why in the latter case is only one name sufficient? Eila shmamina ha de it chazek ha de lo it chazek. Learn then from this change or the seeming contradiction to the new rule of Rabban Gamliel that what? This first case refers to when it's established that the husband actually has two names and I've got to include both names. And the second case is where it's not established that he has two names, and so he went to a place. He wasn't known by anything different. He wrote the get in terms of his name that he's known by in that new place and by which he's known where his wife is currently sitting, and he delivers the get with the name that he's known by both in the new place and by her, and it's the same name, and there's no two names, and I don't have to worry about it. And that's the harmonization that I can make in terms of this brisa that seemingly contradicted Rabban Gamliel's new fix.
How does he establish that he has two names?
Ah.
Or how does one establish?
We did not hear that from within the Gemara.
Right.
We did not hear that. Other than to say that there are witnesses to the writing of a get, and as I mentioned, I believe what it does is it... What is it called when someone who's drafting something, a document, it's an encumbrance, right? Isn't that the term? There's an encumbrance on the writer of the get. He's actually required to ask, what's your name? Do you have any other names? Are you known by a different name on a contract? Are you known by a different name on a ketubah? Are you known by a different name on a birth certificate? Which is why the Masader Gittin, the one who writes the gets in today's world, has to have a full form written by a husband who's requesting a get with all of the different names by which he's known.
So it's by his testimony, by the husband's...
By the husband's testimony and... by the witnesses then signing. Because remember that there are two witnesses that are going to sign and attest to the fact that the husband requested that that get be written for his wife.
And if he says, I'm only known by one name?
Yeah, obviously it's a dilemma.
At the time of this writing, I think you said that it wasn't until 1000 that it was definitely monogamy.
In Ashkenaz.
So, is it possible, so are you saying that this was a legal situation to have two wives, one in the north and one in the south.
Yeah.
So he didn't have to hide this.
No, he didn't.
So for clarity, if there's something fraudulent in the completion of the get, who loses out on that? It seems that the wife would lose out because it would not be considered valid if the husband is something fraudulent.
Correct. And children would lose out big time.
So
because she would be still married, and the children would then be mamzerim, we would call them. They were defined as children born out of wedlock.
So...
Any new children.
Is there some reparation? How is there some way of punishing the fraudulency of this, of the person, of the husband?
Well, I mean, anyone who would not abide by the rules and the particulars of how to write a get, you could say was being confronted by all these very rules and processes himself. You know, they didn't want him to just stop a get and toy with his wife in terms of when she was going to actually get it once she heard, and therefore we have the takana, and here we have the other takana of, you know, if he's known by this and he's known by that. In other words, what would happen? Like, let's take another tack here. Sometimes you have to think like a fiction writer, or a historical fiction writer, or a movie producer. This guy's writing a get, the whole town hears about it. Right? And he says, I, Yosef, send this get to Plony, you know, my wife who's now over there. And somebody in town says, you know, figure this out how it would look, right? That guy's not, you know, just Yosef. That guy's Yochanan over there. You know, maybe there's some of that discussion going on because so many people were so, were just
outraged,
and so many people were dishonest when it came to actually producing this document. And for whatever reason, you know, here's the reason, right? If you get divorced, the ketubah is due. You owe the ketubah. Now, whether you owe the ketubah at the time of your death, and she has to collect it from the estate, or it has to be paid right away, that's in flux during this period. But the reality is that you owe some money. So you got to remember about that part here too. Going through with a divorce is going to cost you. I mean, pretty much
could it be,
does today.
Could it be purposeful to avoid the completion of the get and not allow the wife to have that separation?
Of course.
But purposely being fraudulent?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
There's a lot of focus these days on why the woman wants a valid get, but could we just summarize the main practical motivation for why the husband would want it? Is he being relieved of obligations of marriage?
And any reason. Any reason. Any reason. He could have practically any reason for divorcing his wife.
No. That's not what I mean. I mean, why is the husband so concerned that the get is going to be valid? I mean, what change of status in relationship or obligation in which that would induce him to want to make sure he has a valid
He would get. Still be very responsible for all of the conditions of marriage within the framework of our people.
Right. And
he would still have to provide.
Is going to be greater than whatever the
ketubah
is requiring as far as the divorce.
Definitely.
So he wants that get to be valid.
He needs the separation. He needs the separation because he is really required all of the different pieces: shelter, clothing, some type of sexual relationship. He's got to, you know. Let's say he finds himself. I mean, this could be a practical reality that she also is really so struggling that he's never home. He's a merchant and he's out so far away. She can actually say, I demand this get. And he says, no, but it's okay if I only come home 3 days a year. And she says, no way. But he still wants to do all this, and then it gets to a place where it's just so expensive to make life, and he's struggling, and he's away. You know, these things happen in the ancient world particularly. Sometimes people these days find themselves a world apart from each other, not even the ancient world. We've seen these realities. And so they need to officially sever the relationship. Barry, did you have some?
This issue of names in medicine is particularly problematic. Just comment, when I was resident at Bellevue, the first question we would ask the patient was, when you were here the last time, what name did you use? Because you'd want to get their old records, and if you didn't have the right name, you had no chance. But the other big problem was a lot of people had the same name, especially Hispanic patients often had very, very similar names. And so medicine has dealt with this in a variety of ways, but the central fix is something called a UPIN, UPIN, which is Universal Personal Identification Number. And we face this problem now acutely in New York. because we're now merging all of the electronic health records in the city into one very large data warehouse. And so we've been advantaged because there are now advanced algorithms to use all of the information to see if a patient was admitted to this hospital, same patient admitted to this hospital, that when they merge the data sets, that's recognized as the same person, not two different people, because that's not so easy to do. But the universal personal identification number gets you out from this, because no matter how many names a person has, they all code back to the same number, which is the defining feature. So they could have a million names, but if all of it is them, then it's the central identifier that is the trump.
So the patient knows you've been?
Actually, no, but that's the structure that ideally you like to create. And in some situations, you'll actually create them. You have the same problem in doing bibliographic analyses. So we have something called PubMed that has all of the medical literature. But if somebody's name is Joe Smith, there may be a lot of Joe Smiths who wrote papers, and now you're back in that same problem. And so there are attempts to create UPINs for investigators so that they don't assign someone else's paper to this author. So this is a huge issue in our society. And what's interesting culturally, in the U.S., of course, for many people, not all, but for many people, we could have solved this with the Social Security number, because in essence, your Social Security number is a UPIN, using it to code back to everything else. But for privacy reasons, no one will go there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's me.
Charlie. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think NYU was using handprints, usually Sharon's handprints.
And eventually it'll be your DNS.
Yeah.
You know, the first thing that'll happen is
you may not want anyone to know that anyway.
The ultimate is that you won't even put a patient's name on the tube, because the first test that will be done will be their DNS.
Fascinating. Laura, what were you saying?
After that, that's the personal identifier.
You won't need any names at all. Your name will be for me. By your universal.
Yeah. So let me read you this. Collected a few responses. Rob, you were saying about people moving different places and your parents. Okay. So there's a. This is a kind of collection of some small sources that I think range from about the end of the 16th century through the 18th. A person should never name a child after this is a Jewish person who's trying to create a little bit more of an insular society, so put it in context. Don't name a child after a non-Jew, or after someone who lived before the time of Abraham, because a person should only use the name of someone who kept the entire Torah. Now, what do we know about that? We know in the Gemara already, how many times have we encountered sages and members of the people who have, what? Greek names. We know that this is a reaction and a way of trying to figure out, like, what are we going to do with names?
No Adams.
So, 19th century, several sources. Giving a non-Jewish name to one's child is a violation of a biblical prohibition of following the ways of the nations. They need a new halachic construct to say that it's darkei ha'umot, the ways of the nations that we're not supposed to follow. Oh, so we already know in Torah that that didn't happen, because Yosef was known as what? Sofnat Phaneach. Joseph had an Egyptian name. And it's written in Exodus.
But he names his kids.
You could say, and sources would, right, that he went back and named his children Hebrew names, and that the Midrash, of course, says one of the reasons why the Jewish people was actually redeemed was for what? Keeping their names. Keeping Hebrew names. He understands that it's anathema to use a non-Jewish name later in history, and rejects the notion that you can prove from the earlier sources and the stories in Torah that you could have even a Hebrew name and a local name, which didn't become a practice, by the way, until the Middle Ages and our European family members, in addition to some of the court Jews and merchants in the 8th through 12th centuries in Egyptian, Babylonian, and Eretz Israeli reality, especially as we pull more names of Jews out of the contracts of the Geniza that we've talked about so often. Okay, another one. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, right, and that name should ring familiar in terms of his status here in America as a Lower East Side Jew, right? Mativta down on the Lower East Side, still his family members are there. Right? He didn't think to prohibit the practice of using secular names at all. As so many sages and other Jews mentioned in the Gemara have Greek or Roman names. He says that the Jews in Egypt may have been saved for their cultural adherence to Judaism, but that was only relevant when they didn't have the Torah to keep them together. But those of us who have now Torah and the freedom to relate to Torah, halakha, Jewish culture, shouldn't worry about such certain cultural things as having names like this. Also, he points out, Rabbi Asher Weiss actually points this out as well. There is a Tosafot in Gittin, our Masechet, though not in our section, that Gittin, which come from outside of Israel, are kosher when non-Jewish names are used because Rov Yisrael Shebechul, the majority of Jewish people who are outside of the land of Israel, Shemoteim Kishemot Akum. Their names are like the names of the people of those lands. So already we see in the time of the 13th century Tosafot that in fact many, many Jews who live outside the land of Israel particularly are using names that are in use in various societies and not even Jewish names. Clearly it was common to have a diasporic name, and one might then have a Jewish name in full, or at least be known as Ben or Bat someone. So the notion of having two names is in flux at some point in the history. So I told you at the beginning of looking at this, that we would get into names in a little bit even deeper way. I want to turn to some sources about names in a second. Read the end of the Gemara before we go there, because we have to understand that it's, you know, they bring realities. What do we do with certain realities? Here's another reality. Hahi dehavu karu la Miriam. There was a certain woman who was called Miriam by most residents of her town. Ufurta Sarah, but a few called her Sarah. Now concerning her gift, Amre Neharadaye, the Nehardean rabbi said that the get must read Miriam v'chol shum sheyeshla, Miriam and every name that she has, v'lo Sarah v'chol shum sheyeshla, and not Sarah and every name that she has. Meaning what? That the primary name, and Rashi refers to this, the primary name is the one by which we have to write. And since only a few people call her Sarah, I don't really need it. What's the point here?
Because
A few people who call somebody something else doesn't establish that they have two names.
What if it's a husband?
Even less.
This seems to make clear that this is literally the one that gets included, you know, Miriam and every name that she has. Not a list of the exact names, but just and every name that she has, which means that if you only include one of them anyway, how does this even address the issue?
Good, so back to the original question. What's the Gemara going to really be about? It ends on the note of a formula that basically says, Miriam and every name she has.
So it could be to anybody.
And maybe that's exactly what Rabban Gamliel wanted the fix to be. To say the following. I don't establish exactly what names are. Yosef, Yochanan, Yankala. What I write is, the guy who came here is Yossi. Yossi asked me to write a get. Yossi and every name he's known by asked me to write this get. And if you tell me that he's known by this over here, and therefore that get is going to be invalid because of some legal technicality. No. That's no technicality. This get's going to be good. And we're going to use this formula to include every name he's known by and make sure that what? The get's valid, it's delivered, and she's divorced. No question asked. And that's tikkun olam. That's the fix.
People
did not have surnames. People did not have surnames.
They even referred to his father or mother.
They used to be called by profession.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. People would be called by a singular name that had a lot of meaning. Sometimes, formulaically, they could be referred to as the son of. And we see that in Torah, right, already, that the genealogies go back several generations. So we know that there was a way in the ancient world that people were referred to by the lineup of who their ancestors were. But sometimes in legal documents, the answer is no. They weren't. They were just called by their names by which they were known. Well, in terms of the surname, let me see if I've got that piece, because I brought... Yeah, I don't have the article here. Surnames, I found some articles this week that talk about when surnames actually came into being and when Jewish surnames particularly came into being. And Jewish surnames, it turns out, were thought to by some... not be. Hold on one second.
Many of the Ashkenazi surnames are because of the place where they were born, where their profession.
Profession.
Okay, so this is in a magazine called Esra, and it's by a woman named Edith Dinar. Other than aristocrats and wealthy people, Jews did not get surnames in Eastern Europe until the Apollonic years of the early 19th century. Most of the Jews from countries captured by Napoleon, Russia, Poland, and Germany, were ordered to get surnames for tax purposes. After Napoleon's defeat, many Jews dropped these names and returned to son of names such as Mendelssohn, Jacobson, Levinson. During the so-called emancipation, Jews were once more ordered to take surnames. In Austria, the Emperor Joseph made Jews take last names in the late 1700s, Poland in 1821, and Russia in 1844. It's probable that some of our families have had last names for 175 years or less. In France and the Anglo-Saxon countries, surnames went back, though, to the 16th century. Sephardic Jews also had surnames stretching back centuries. Spain, prior to Ferdinand and Isabella, was a golden spot for Jews. They were expelled by Isabella in the same year that Columbus left for America. The earliest American Jews were Sephardic. In general, there were five types of names. People had to pay for their choice of names. The poor had assigned names. Names that were descriptive of head of household. Hoch, tall. Klein, small. Cohen, a rabbi. That's why everybody who's named Cohen, by the way, is not a Kohen. Berger is a village dweller. Shine is a good-looking soul. Shane upon him. Levi, or Levi, a temple singer. Gross, large. Schwartz, dark or black. Weiss, white. And Kurtz, short. Here are names describing occupations. Holtz, wood. Holtzkocker, a wood chopper. Geldschmidt, a goldsmith. Schneider is a tailor. Kriegsman, a warrior. Melamed, a teacher. Eisen, an iron worker. And Fisher, a fisherman. Names from the city of residence were also popular. Berliner, Frankfurter, Danziger, Oppenheimer, Deutsch, Pollock, Breslau, Mannheim. Pollock being about a country and not even a city. Krakow, Warsaw as last names.
Poland, when they get the ski, when they're saying like, oh, if you have a last name ski, you can be a Kohen. What is that? It's really going around like, oh, any Kohen or any, oh, ski, and like, oh, so, yeah, I'm a Kohen.
Not exactly sure.
So the name Kravitz. It's a Kohen. It's called Rabbi Yeshua Goel Tzadikim, and that has nothing to do with location.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think they just made sometimes acronyms. You have to translate for people.
Is someone telling me August?
Basically, he's saying that there's one name
French.
That Kohenim are holy.
German. It's Schindler.
Tell me again.
Rabbi, it's called Rabbi Yeshua Goel Tzadikim.
The voice of joy and righteousness in the tent of the righteous. So I don't know if they're all Kohanim.
They're all Kohanim.
I don't know that.
Cats.
I know if you.
Cats is Kohanim. Kravitz is Kohanim.
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't know that that's true. I think I know some Kravitz who are Levi.
I don't know if today Kravitz, some of the singers, is Kohen, but the original name, they're all Kohanim.
Could be. Here are some bot names. Gluck is Luck. Rosen is roses. Rosenberg is Rose Mountain. Rosenblatt, a rose paper or leaf. Rosenfeld, a rose field. Rothman is a red man. Diamond. Koenig is a king. Koenigsberg is a king's mountain. Now, here are some names that are undesirable but got assigned to certain people within the community and shows that we weren't always so kind.
Stinky.
Plots. He should die. Klutz.
Klutz.
Clumsy. Billig. So everybody would know he's a cheapskate. And Dreck.
Right. He's onomatopoeic.
Okay. Before I get to some of the original Jewish names of some people that you know, I want to take a look at these sources. Take one of these, pass it around. These are sources. I've called this sheet, What's in a Name? Havadayik Bishma. Should we really be so concerned with what's in a name? So obviously we should be concerned if people would be so rude as to give names that really insult people. Obviously, that's there. But the rabbis in the Gemara relate to the question of just what meaning do I ascribe to names, and I'm really going to look at this with you. We're going to look at this in Chavruta. What do you think they really are meaning to ask by telling you this story? That is the question. So I'm going to now read through the story with you. It's in Yoma. It's in the 8th perek of Yoma. And Yoma is the tractate that deals with Yom Kippur. So you're talking about very, very existential religious questions if you're dealing with the tractate of Yom Kippur. And you're talking about, you know, life and the greatness of having this life of flesh and blood in the background and the backdrop. I'll just add that. Okay, Vatu. And furthermore, it's going to be told of this story. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi were walking on the road together. Havu ka azli ba'orecha. They were on the way. And Rabbi Meir havadayek bishma, and Rabbi Meir would analyze names and discern one's nature. and try to tell something about a person by a name. Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yosef lo hava daiku bishma. And Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yosef were not so interested in thinking about the meaning of names, or figuring out if names could mean anything or tell you anything. Kimatu lahahu duchta. When they came to a certain place, ba'u ushpiza, the host, the tavern manager came over, yahavulu, and they were given a spot in the inn. Okay, a tavern manager is an ushpiza. We often think about ushpizin at Sukkot as being the holy and sacred guests. Well, ushpiza is the word for an innkeeper, one who hosts guests. Amru lo, they said to the innkeeper, Ma shimcha, what's your name? Amar lahu, kidur. Oh, Rabbi Meir sees in that immediately. Amar, shma mina adam rashahu, I see in him a very evil person. Based on the name, by the way. As it's stated, Shenemar Kidor Tapuchot Hema, for their generation, Kidor of rabble rousers, upheavers. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Rabbi Yossi Ashlimu Le Kisaihu. Now, since it was Sabbath oncoming, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi give him their wallets. Kisaihu. You know, you check into certain hotels and you can put your valuables in the safe and you can give the and you have to give your passport. You know, things like this happen in the ancient world for Shabbat. You needed to definitely keep things safe. Rabbi Meir lo ashlim le kisei. But Rabbi Meir wouldn't trust him by giving over his wallet. Remember, he's the one who said that this name indicates that this guy's a rabble-rouser and an evildoer. Azal otvei be kivre davuha, and placed it at the grave of his innkeeper's, of the innkeeper's father. By the way, that, you know, burying your money in the ground was one way to keep your wallet safe. Only you would remember. So you have to have some sign about where it is. Eat chazi le bechelme. The innkeeper's father appeared to the innkeeper in a dream and said to him, Ta shakil kisa, go take the purse placed at the head, Aresha the hahu gavra, at the head of that man, the innkeeper's father. Lamachar Amar Lahu, the next day he said to them, the sages, Hachi itchazi li bechelma. This is what appeared to me in my dream. Amri Lay, they said to him, Chelma deve shimshe late bahum mamasha. Dreams during twilight on Shabbat evening have no substance and shouldn't be trusted. Azal Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir went and guarded the money. Kula yoma v'aitai. All that day. And then took it. Lamachar Amrulo. The next day they said to him, Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, Havlan kisan. Give us back our purses. Give us back our wallets. Amar lahu. He said to them, Lo hayu devarim ha'olam. You never gave me your wallets. You didn't give me your purses. Amar lahu Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir then says, Amar lo daiketu bishma. Why didn't you just listen to his name? And what I learned from his name, this guy was Russia from the start, evildoer. Amrule, and they said to him, Amar lo amrat lanmar. Why didn't you really convince us? Amar lahu, he says to them, Amar de amri ana chashasha. He said to them, I said you should suspect this guy of being such an evildoer. Achuzake mi amri. But have I said a person should be really established as wicked entirely based on a name alone? So that is the classic locus of the one big sugya we have about whether or not you can learn something from a name. So what do you think? What do we learn?
Never call your daughter Yafa.
Ron says, don't call your daughter beautiful. What, everybody's going to think she's beautiful?
If she's not, she's in trouble.
If she's not, she's in trouble. That is an old bit of Israeli wisdom, right?
What do we learn from this?
That's what I want to know.
I know what we learn from this. No good deed goes unpunished. They didn't like the outcome, so they turned around to the master and blamed him for not persuading men. Have you not had that happen to you in your life 85 times? I have. It's just extraordinary that it's here in the Mishnah.
Yeah.
The translation said he said to himself, maybe this guy has a bad character. But in the text, it just says, Lamar.
Yeah, I don't think he said to himself. Yeah. I honestly don't. I think he did kind of give them the warning.
Well, he kept his purse.
Where's not his purse?
That's idiomatic fill-in from Steinsaltz. Yeah. Where it's not in the bold. The bold is the actual translation of words, and the not bold parts of this translation, just like with our Schottenstein Gemara, is the same. Where, you know, it's idiomatic English. He's trying to create an idiomatic flow, and he's interpreting the Gemara as he goes along, which is why we say every translation is really an interpretation.
Okay. But he didn't give his
person. So,
it's a teleological, let's say, just teleological, he re-edits the text based on the last part of the story.
That's right. That's right. He kind of lets the end inform his reading above, and that's not all the time, I think, exactly the way the Gemara works and that Midrash works, but...
takes a lot of the mystery out of it when you fill in the
blanks. Why is it important?
I don't know.
Here's
the thing. I don't find that it's worth the space.
Why did you include your card for us? Is there a meaning?
Oh, I did these two sources with a group that asked me to think about names with them at one time.
I thought you were going to place something, a rip-off of your name.
No.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I could tell you that I was debating, after doing all this work on the Gemara, whether or not I should include my Hebrew name on my card. Because I looked at it tonight, and I said, you know what? I don't really have my Hebrew name on this card. Yeah, Henry?
This story can have serious implications. I mean, if you suspect somebody of something, you could be wary yourself, but if you relate your suspicions, it could turn into Lashon Hara.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, bottom line is I think there's a warning in this. It comes in the eighth parak of Yoma, so there are mitzvot that we have to do, and there's repentance on Yom Kippurim, on Yom Kippur, and there's a way of relating to the world and others, and sometimes, I don't know if you've heard this, and if we ourselves, we're not guilty of such a thing, sometimes I have heard people have aversions to certain names, based on experiences with other people with those same names. This happens. It might sound, a little bit small-minded, but people sometimes avoid certain names. That's A. B is, on an even deeper level, if I smear your name based on some cultural attachment that I put on it, like we have meaningful names in the Bible all over the place in terms of Hebraic roots. And, all of a sudden we are going to make a word play and a pun on that guy's name based on our verses of Torah. It's a warning in some ways against that, even though there seems to be some very, very bad behavior on behalf of the innkeeper here. And, by the way, the innkeeper is turned into an evil doer by the very words that are spoken here. And it's a warning against Lashon Hara in a very deep way. It really is. Because what happens in the Gemara that is beyond this paragraph is that this innkeeper gets so angry that these two rabbis go to his wife. And it actually, connecting back now a little bit with what can happen between a husband and a wife, where people start to, through Lashon Hara or through any kind of means, start to create self-fulfilling prophecies of such and such and so is so evil and so nasty. He goes back to his wife, who just had encountered Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi, who said, that we got some sign that you were supposed to return the wallets to us, and she actually knew where the wallets were. She returns the wallets. He comes home, and he kills her. Now, that's a gruesome story. And so the question on these kinds of stories all the time is, what do we learn? What must we learn? For sure, the very nature of using Lashon Hara. Secondly, for using a verse of Torah to ascribe such evil doing to a potential innkeeper. And then there's the other aspect where there is some clue about the world within verses of Torah, but what kind of read of the verses will we really make? This is a deep question that the Gemara is asking. There are those who read this a little bit more philosophically, that it's not a story that really happened at all. That in fact, Rabbi Meir comes in and he says, this whole life, the life we're blessed with, needs to be a spiritual life. We need to rise above the kind of commerce and exchange of going into the inn and preparing for the Sabbath, that somehow I have to take care of that myself. But Rabbi Yehuda's and Rabbi Yossi's position is that, no, we can be trusting souls when it comes to contracts and asking people for help, and they'll guard your goods, and it will all work out that the Sabbath and dealing with the outside world of an innkeeper who doesn't have Sabbath obligations will be fine. And the point is, in a philosophical sense, that in this case, Rabbi Meir is arguing for a more spiritual existence and not asking anyone for help with that spiritual existence in terms of Sabbath and in terms of the notion that you are yes, with body and embodied as a person, but that you need to live on this kind of soul level of avoiding all evil, and that the innkeeper represents some of the forces that will keep you from doing that which you know you're commanded to do, a la Sabbath, a la the purest kind of mitzvot that you can do, so that at Yom Kippur time, since it's in Yoma and in this tractate about Yom Kippur, that you're really making your own decisions and making your own path without the evildoer that's embodied in this innkeeper. But the sources don't allow that to be the end game, that somebody can be called an evildoer just because of his name. The sources that are complementary vis-a-vis the topic often come in Midrash. And I brought you one of the most expansive pieces of Midrash down below. This is in Vayikra Rabbah. I don't think the source, for neither of them actually, did the source make it onto the page. This is a commentary about the book of Leviticus, when people are guilty, when people are not guilty, and what kind of offerings we bring, and about keeping true to keeping your good intentions about you vis-a-vis others, and acknowledging that some people might see that name sounds foreign to me, and I just, you know, immediately define them as other, but acknowledging also that sometimes that really can't be the way that you relate to the world. And so the source says, Rabbi Yossi Bar Hanina said, there are four types of names. There are those whose names are pleasant and whose actions are pleasant. There are those whose names are ugly and whose actions are ugly. There are those whose names are ugly and whose actions are pleasant. And there are those whose names are pleasant and whose actions are ugly. In other words, you know, what really is in a name? And that did bring me kind of back to relating it to the Gemara that we're learning in terms of this philosophical level of the husband who writes a name and doesn't, according to that one part of the Braita, include that other name by which he's known, so that it effectively creates the severance in the relationship, that the divorce is valid, that is someone who ultimately winds up with an ugly name. And we have to be, you know, deeply, deeply careful when it comes to making sure we have a legal system that is inclusive of all the names that a person has, so that we can make the biggest tikkun olam that's possible. We can make the biggest fix. And whether that's the general statement, like in the end, this name and every name that he has, and this name and every name that she has, or it's actually listing the names specifically, that's an important question and an important note on how the world gets fixed. That we don't allow anyone to slip by because they've used a name and not included another. And that they have to realize that by any name, they have to do the right thing. If you're a human being and you have a name, you do the right thing. And it's that explicit about the name. Because we're really talking in the Mishnah about including the names. And in order to make the biggest fix and have the most righteous of ways carried forward, we're not only going to now talk about the names of the husband and the names of the wife, but we're going to get even deeper in terms of our Gemara into the names of the witnesses. And we want to make sure that the names of the witnesses get into the picture as well, and that we can really tell indeed that this was written, this get, that it was witnessed by real people who we can ask, was the get really prepared correctly, that it includes all the names of the husband and wife, as this Mishnah makes clear it should. So now we're going to turn to the next Mishnah already, and we're really plowing through material. I'm not going to deal with the first part of the next Mishnah. I'm going to deal with the last part of the next Mishnah. Look at the top of what is 34b3 in the Schottenstein edition here. It's the second part of the next Mishnah in the Perek. And it says, Ha'edim chotmin al ha'get. The witnesses should sign on a get, mipnei tikkun olam. Mipnei tikkun olam. Because these practices are instituted to really put the fix on the world that we need. The Hillel hikin, and we don't even need the next piece. We just need that one little small sentence. Ha'edim chotmin al ha'get. So, this is a very important kind of remark. And what are we going to do with that remark just linked to our topic tonight? Go to 36A1 now. The ha'edim chotmin al ha'get midnei tikkun ha'olam. And the witnesses sign on the get for the benefit of society. I'm on the right-hand side on the column there. You see it? Mipnei tikkun ha'olam, because it's an enactment for the fixing of the legal system for the benefit of society, but I say the rectification of the legal system. De'araitahu, it is a biblical requirement that they sign. Dichtiv, how do I know that it's actually a biblical requirement? By the way, I don't really have that in the part that we read in terms of the sources. He delivers her a sefer kritut. He delivers her a document of severance. But it doesn't say anything there in Deuteronomy about signing. So they're going to bring you a verse. This question has come up over the years in the Beit Midrash. Can I actually prove something? Is deraita is from the Torah through a verse from the prophets? So yes, this one's going to put out a special kind of proof from a verse from the prophets. It's going to say the following. Dichtiv, it's written, v'chato b'sefer v'chatom, that you should write the document and you should sign it. Now this really is about people being instructed to buy fields again when they're coming back from exile, and they should write the documents and they should actually have signatures on the document to effectively make the contracts. And so the Gemara answers, Amar Rabba, Rabba says, Lo tzricha l'Rabbi Elazar. No, it is necessary for the rabbis to institute signing a get according to the view of Rabbi Elazar. De'amar ade nesira korte, who says that it is the witnesses of the delivery of the get who invest it with the power to sever the marital bond. So the witnesses who actually deliver the get are the ones who actually say that the divorce happens, and according to this view, I don't even really need those witnesses who see it being written to actually sign anything. So what do I need to do? I need to legislate that in fact it's not exactly like Rab Elazar says, that the witnesses to the delivery are the only important witnesses. I need the witnesses who see the get being written to attest to the validity of the legal document. Takinu Rabbanan Adei Chatima. The rabbis instituted that a get should have witnesses who sign it, mipnei tikkun ha'olam, for the benefit of society, dizminin demaitei sahadei, for sometimes the witnesses who observe the delivery of the get will die, or will no longer be available.
But the same is for the original
witnesses. Inami, well, good question. Inami.
They're going to put their sail across it.
Remember that statement too. Inami zimin da'azle limidinat ayam, or sometimes they'll go overseas and they'll disappear. So if I don't have that set of witnesses available to me, maybe I'll have this set of witnesses available to me. No one's guaranteeing anything. If we're talking about situations where people either die, fly away, go to other lands, I have to worry about it from both sides, and I have to worry about it. But okay, so we have more witnesses who are possible, vis-a-vis testifying to the fact that this is the get, it was valid, this guy actually requested it, in addition to those who saw the delivery. Now Rav Yosef says, I have a different way of understanding the Mishnah and the fix that was included that they have to sign the get. Afilu tema l'Rabbi Meir, you can even say that our Mishnah follows the position of Rabbi Meir, who says that it is the witnesses who signed the get that invested with the power to sever the marital bond. In other words, I had before the position of Rabbi Elazar, who said, no, it's the witnesses who actually witnessed the delivery that make it effective. Here, if I go with the Shita, the position of Rabbi Meir, who says, no, I still need the witnesses who signed the writing of the get, and that's what makes it effective, because he's going to learn what? From that verse from Jeremiah, which makes it d'oraita. He learns a verse from the prophets, which makes it a Torahitic law. What was really meant by the Mishnah when the Mishnah said that the witnesses have to sign it is what? That they actually have to be very explicit about their names. They should write their names. Mipnei tikkun ha'olam. Because that's how you effectuate tikkun olam, the fixing of the world. Ki d'tanya, as it was taught in the Braita, Barishona hayach chotev ani ploni chatam tied. Because at first they would just write, I'm ploni. Literally, I thought that the formula that I was supposed to write based on the legal teachings that you made is, I'm ploni the aid. Literally ploni. Didn't write out any specific name on the document. Just so-and-so. Im katav yado yotzei mimakom acher kasher. And if his handwriting appeared elsewhere, in other words, I had a document that had his handwriting, and I knew it with a check, because I needed to see if this witness was a kosher witness, and I could check in with him to say, hey, did so-and-so actually ask for a written get? The way that I know that it's actually you in this town who came as the aide, remember, like, I'm not dealing with massive civilizations worth of population. If I know your handwriting because it's on a legal document somewhere, I can go to you and say, hey, I see your handwriting is on this. Wait, did you sign? I'm Plony, and I signed here? And you say, oh, yeah. Well, guess what? That's a problem. Right? Because maybe my handwriting over here is not exactly like my handwriting over here. Can I just rely on handwriting? I mean, handwriting experts will tell you that it's hard for me to get away, even if I change from my left hand to my right hand, that you couldn't tell for real if you were a real expert that, you know, oh, it's still Bolton who's writing that. But there are those standard documents that can look very different depending on what you write. The im lov pasul. But if his handwriting didn't appear elsewhere, the get would be invalid. Here's the real problem. If I didn't have a document with his handwriting, I couldn't even compare the two handwritings, I would have to say that the get's not even valid. Amar Rabban Gamliel comes along and says, Takana gedola hikinu, I have a great fix here. There's all the forms of the shoresh in its, right? Takana, from tikkun. I have a law, a decree. Takana has a stronger sense than just a decree, hachraza. And a stronger sense than just halacha, stronger sense than even just the law. I have a real takana. The rabbis instituted this great institution, sheyihyu mefarshim shmoteihem begitin, that they should write out their full names on a get, these witnesses. Mipnei tikkun olam. And what I would say on the philosophical level is that tikkun olam is then what? Effectuated both by way of the husband-wife issues in terms of names, both by way of the witnesses and how they used to do it versus the new way, that the fixes, yes, are legislative and in the law, but it's about individual people affirming the fix that's needed in society as much as it is Rabban Gamliel actually making the fix. That what we're seeing in terms of the tikkun olam, development of the idea of tikkun olam, is that recognizable individuals must be party to any of the legal processes, any of the rectification of relationships that we are talking about that are at the center of these questions in the Masechet, and any of the general legal rulings and legal processes that I'm defining in terms of the rabbinic way of doing business in the world. And I have to write my full name. Here's just a very fun way to end this. You know, you mentioned their seal or their sign or whatever. Yeah, uvesimana lo, but you can't sign with a mere mark. Sorry. Vaha Rav Tzair kavra, but when signing a document, Rav would draw a fish. He would use a fish in place of his name. Rabbi Chanina Tzair haruta, and Rabbi Chanina would draw a palm branch. Rav Chisda samech, and Rav Chisda would draw the letter samech. Rabbi Hoshaya Ayin, and Rabbi Hoshaya would draw an actual letter Ayin. Rabbi Barbar Huna Tzayer Mechuta, and Rabbi Rav Huna would draw a sail. So the rabbi's answer about these guys and their seals, right? Everything from a palm branch to a sama to an Ayin to a sailboat. Shane Rabbana. The rabbis are different. Divakin Simanaihu. Since their marks are very well known and they do them so artfully, we accept them. Well, Ke'ikara b'may afakinu. How did their marks originally become well known? The Gemara answers, b'diske, through their general correspondence. So that the culture of writing so much legislation, documentation, halakhic answers, asking for different documents that prove, these became documents that were so familiar in the culture, could you believe, that they had their own little symbols. And, you know, think about how different kinds of symbols have become for some entertainers or some kind of bands, you know, the way that we recognize these things. Logos have become so popular. These were the logos of the rabbis. And certain rabbis had them already. And like the heksher for food, there's a heksher for law. There's a symbol that says this is tikkun olam. This is a fix for the world. And with their seals sometimes, they would seal whatever their legislation. And the inclusion of this at the end is to say that sometimes you look for the name of the individual and sometimes we can see the seal of approval by great sages, and hopefully they'll be only for the kind of tikkun olam that Rabban Gamliel is really about in these Mishnayot.
We have a break next week. Thank
you. Yes, everybody should have a very sweet Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
well, look, if I had a symbol, it was even better for me, because as a fish or a sail, then I could see it, and it would be obvious to me more than even if I signed my name to somebody who had it.